Along with athlete's foot and hemorrhoids, one of the most annoying things you may ever experience is the horrible noise you're hearing right now, also known as the last night of the proms. The sound of embarrassing British patriotism is akin to the howling of dogs, as far as I'm concerned. But what makes it even more deeply irritating is the special pride of place given to the rather good song that they're murdering as I speak. Jerusalem. If these jingoistic halfwits waving their Union Jacks paused and thought about the words even for a millisecond, then they would realise that this isn't actually a patriotic hymn at all, but rather an environmental protest song, perhaps the first environmental protest song ever written. The author of the original poem, William Blake, was railing against the industrialisation of the English landscape. The dark satanic mills that these sheep-like English hordes are singing so cheerfully about aren't in any way metaphorical, but rather the very real sulphur-belching cotton mills and paper mills that had resulted from the British exploitation of energy from coal. In last week's episode, I talked about the way in which the chemical energy from coal was first employed to produce useful work in the context of pumping water from coal mines. In subsequent decades, an improved version of this engine, redesigned in 1765 by James Watt, began to be employed to provide useful work in other industrial situations. For factories in particular, this was a godsend. No longer were they dependent on sites with favourable wind and flowing water to provide energy. Factories could now be located for easy transportation of goods via canal or sea, or for proximity to existing populations of potential workers. And the increases in productivity were remarkable. To give but one example, hand-spun cotton in the early 1700s required more than 1,100 hours of labour to produce a single kilogram of yarn. But by 1825, it took only 3 hours of labour to produce the same amount using a machine, only 1/370th of the previous labour cost. Unfortunately, the conditions for most of the workers in these factories can only be described as horrific by modern standards. With a few notable exceptions, the hours were long, the working environment was appalling, the pay was minuscule, and severe injuries and even fatalities were commonplace. Children as young as 7 were employed, working as much as 13 hours per day, and the sulphurous smoke and pollution produced by these factories fully justified the description of dark and satanic. One of the contributory factors to these acrid fumes was the incredibly low efficiency of the early steam engines. Although Watt's engine was a major improvement over its predecessors, its efficiency was still only 4.5%. Each joule of useful work that it produced required an input of 22 joules of chemical energy from coal. And this meant that vast amounts of coal had to be burnt in order to provide comparatively modest amounts of useful work. So why was engine efficiency so low? Well, the short answer is that science hadn't caught up with the advances in engineering. The early engines weren't energy efficient because, in a scientific sense, energy hadn't actually been discovered yet. In fact, no one had even realised that work and heat were both manifestations of the same thing. They were even measured in entirely different units, heat in something called British thermal units, or BTUs, and mechanical work in some equally mysterious units called foot-pound force. It wasn't until the mid-1800s that the equivalence of heat and work was demonstrated by an English scientist called James Prescott Joule. His apparatus is so simple that nowadays it could be duplicated in anyone's backyard shed. It simply consists of a known weight attached to a rope, which in turn is attached via a pulley system to a stirrer in an insulated bucket of water. As the weight is dropped, the stirrer rotates and stirs the water in the bucket. What Joule was able to show with his experiment was that the work done by the falling weight in stirring the bucket of water didn't just vanish into the ether, but was actually transformed intrathermal energy, which stayed within the insulated bucket and raised the temperature of the water. Joule had discovered that the ability to do work, or energy as it's now called, is not actually something that can be created or destroyed, merely transformed from one form to another. This means, for example, that the chemical energy from coal is not used up when it's burnt in a steam engine, but merely transformed into other forms of energy. A small amount into useful work, but most of it into heat or thermal energy, which is rejected via the smokestack. A portion of the original coal energy is even transformed into the acoustic energy that our ears detect as sound. This was such an important scientific revelation that Joule was honoured by having the measurement unit of energy named after him, and his findings were immortalised as the first law of thermodynamics, where thermo refers to heat and dynamic refers to work. It was the final nail in the coffin for machines that claimed to be able to create energy from nowhere, otherwise known as perpetual motion machines, and for the first time, it gave the means for engineers to calculate just how lousy their engines actually were, as they made the comparison between heat input to the steam engine and the useful work output. But here's an interesting question. From Joule's discovery about energy, it would seem perfectly reasonable to conclude, as some 19th century engineers did, that the maximum achievable efficiency for a coal-powered steam engine should be close to 100%. After all, if heat and work are equivalent forms of energy, then, allowing for a few minor losses, nearly all of the heat obtained from burning coal should be able to be converted into useful work in a well-designed engine, shouldn't it? Well, no, actually. Joule's discovery shed light on earlier work by a French engineer called Sadie Carnot. Carnot had speculated that there was an upper limit to the efficiency of engines. This theory of his Carnot limit was further developed by Joule and one of Joule's collaborators, William Thomson, who later became Lord Kelvin, as well as a German mathematician and physicist, Rudolf Clausius. And eventually, this became known as the Kelvin-Planck statement of the second law of thermodynamics. To understand, in simplistic terms, why this second law of thermodynamics means that an engine can never be 100% efficient, you have to consider the fact that all heat engines require a working fluid. This is the substance inside the engine which is heated by burning the fuel and which produces a work output, usually by pushing on a piston or a turbine. In a steam engine, the working fluid is steam and water. In a car engine or a jet engine, the working fluid is air. As an engine enacts the process whereby heat is transformed into work, then the temperature of the working fluid is reduced. And in order for an engine to transform all of the input heat energy into useful work, then the temperature of the working fluid would have to be reduced to the point at which all molecular motion ceases, a temperature of exactly negative 273.15 degrees Celsius. Now, there are obvious practical objections to running part of an engine at this sort of temperature. But even apart from this, the coldest known naturally occurring temperature is found in interstellar space at only negative 270 degrees Celsius, still 3 degrees short of the temperature that the working fluid in an engine would have to reach in order to fully convert heat into work. In fact, there are theoretical reasons to think that such a temperature can never be reached, a theory, by the way, known as the third law of thermodynamics. Because we live on a nice, warm planet, the minimum temperature that the working fluid in an engine can reach is, well, just above room temperature. In other words, about 300 degrees above the temperature needed to fully convert heat into work. Given the high temperature constraints on engine materials, this means that the maximum efficiency that can be reached for an engine, even in theory, is only around 70%. The discovery of the first and second laws of thermodynamics was something of a good news, bad news story for 19th century engineers. The bad news was that their engines were horribly inefficient. The good news was that the inefficiency wasn't quite as bad as it looked, because in practice, the maximum theoretical efficiency of a heat engine is a lot less than 100%. And I suppose the other good news was that the laws of thermodynamics gave engineers some very good information about how to improve the efficiency of their engines. In the late 1800s, this culminated in a machine designed by a German engineer called Rudolf Diesel. Diesel was a university-educated engineer who set out to design an engine according to thermodynamic principles so that it would attain the highest possible efficiency. His early attempts to fuel his engine with coal dust were failures, but he finally achieved success when he used a relatively new fuel called oil. Diesel's invention would eventually supplant the steam engine in most applications, including ships and the machine that revolutionized transportation in the 1800s, the train. But more on that next week.